Welcome to the Rights Track Podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about the human rights challenges facing the world today. I'm Todd Landman, and in today's episode, we're asking how do we measure and explain the phenomenon of modern slavery? My guest is Kevin Bales, professor of contemporary slavery at the Wilberforce Institute for the Study of Slavery and Emancipation at the University of Hull in the United Kingdom. He was co-founder of Free the Slaves in Washington, D.C., and is lead author of the Global Slavery Index. Last month, he published a new book, Blood and Earth, which examines the relationship between environmental degradation and slavery. It's a real honor to have you here today, Kevin, and it's nice to have someone physically with me. Typically, our podcasts are from all over the world, but you managed to make it here today to Nottingham, and we're absolutely delighted to have you on this episode of The Rights Track. I'm going to start by asking a really straightforward question. In what way do you measure slavery, and why is this important?
Well, it's very important to measure slavery because without a metric, it's very difficult to understand if we're making any progress to reduce the amount of slavery. So there's a very simple notion like that, the metric that will help us to reduce the amount of slavery. But measuring slavery has always been a real challenge. And in fact, I would probably say the last time we had a good measurement of slavery, a truly representative measurement of slavery, was the 1860 census in the United States. When slavery was legal, you could have real counts of people who were in slavery. But since slavery became illegal in virtually every country in the world, and today in every country of the world, it's become a hidden crime. It's become a crime that's very difficult to measure. And we've been facing that serious challenge of knowing there's a significant global issue with people in slavery, but not knowing precisely how to get at the real numbers of people in slavery. So there's been a big push in the last 10 years to understand how we're going to get away from just secondary information guesses, and get up to some primary information to help us take real counts of people who are really in slavery.
So that's really interesting, because a lot of our listeners might think that slavery was something from history, that you know, the slavery was abolished in the United States in the 1850s, the trade itself was abolished, and then after the Civil War, the practice, as it were, was abolished. The last country to abolish slavery was Brazil in the 1880s. And yet you're saying that there are instances and there's a prevalence and variation in slavery today in the modern world. Can you say a little bit about the prevalence of slavery? So what is a modern form of slavery and how prevalent is it in the world?
I could give you probably 50 examples of modern forms of slavery, but in the same way that if we looked across history, you'd also discover that there were many, many types of forms of slavery. And I think in some ways it's the core definition that we understand about what slavery is that helps us to understand it more than to talk about the different forms. So I think what's crucial is to remember that slavery today is what it's always been. So a complete control of one person by another person, violence being used to maintain that control, and then that control and violence being used to exploit the person in some way, economically, possibly sexually, possibly both, and so forth. So this complete control, treating a person as if they are an item of property, not legal, obviously, because that legal slavery is gone, but as if they were an item of property, and you could use them in the same way that you would use something that you owned as property.
These people are not paid, right? So this is coerced labor, or is there some sort of exchange of finance?
There's certainly the question of sustenance. You know, that you normally feed your slaves.
Yep.
You normally house your slaves. But beyond that, normally, there is no pay for people in slavery. There could be tokenistic payments, which are given to people in slavery to encourage them to work harder. But the key is not about remuneration. Slavery has never been determined by the presence or absence of remuneration. It's always been about the total control. And in some ways, when I'm in the field and I'm looking at people who may or may not be in slavery, my rule of thumb question is first, can they walk away? And can they walk away even into a worse situation? So if they can walk away and literally starve to death in a gutter, that's harsh, but that's not slavery. But if they are controlled to the point that they lack free will, they lack freedom of movement, then they are in slavery. And then you can begin to talk about the nature and the mechanism by which they are enslaved.
And can you give me just an example? So a country, a place, a time?
Sure. In northern India, for example, we have a hereditary form of slavery, which the technical name is heredity collateral debt bondage slavery. And I've met many families who have been in that situation, often in their third, fourth, even fifth generation of enslavement to the same family. It comes about when you come to me and you say, my child is dying, they must have some medicine, but can you loan me some money to buy medicine? And I say to you as a landlord, I'm sorry, but I know you. You know, you're a landless peasant. You have nothing to give me as collateral. I'm afraid I can't help you. And then when you beg again, please help me save my child, I say, well, there is one way we could do this, and that's this. If you give me yourself and all the work that you do and all the work of your family as collateral, then I will give you the 400 rupees you need to buy the penicillin. We make that exchange, and from that day forward, I control you, and I also have as my property all of your effort, all of your energy, all of your work, as well as that of your family, which of course makes it impossible for you to repay the debt of the 400 rupees you need to buy the penicillin. That's why it's called collateral hereditary debt bondage slavery.
And of course, this is somewhat informally organized. There's no contract, as it were. And so people who enter into one of those arrangements may find themselves in a duration that could be endless, right?
Well, one of the parts of the legal definition, as well as the sort of conceptual definition of enslavement, is that it's of an indeterminate length of time.
Right.
But indeed, there sometimes are pieces of paper written down, but this is just part of the control mechanism that can be waved in front of an illiterate peasant that says, if you break this, then not only will I harm you, but I can also get the police to come and harm you.
Okay, so if we then sort of zoom out from that very sure. specific case in northern India, you built a global slavery index, and this is an index that's published annually. Or semi-annually?
Annually for the first couple of years. We're just on the third edition now,
okay.
A year late, as it were. But that was primarily because we were in negotiations with some large data providers. Yeah.
Right. And so how many countries do you cover in this?
168.
Wow, that's amazing. And then what sorts of things does the index tell us?
Well, a number of things. The most exciting part for me as someone who's been hoping to measure this for a long time is this notion of prevalence. So we're doing our best to understand literally how many slaves are in the population of different countries around the world. And when we present that information, we often present it as the proportion of the population which is enslaved, as opposed to the raw numbers. But we give both, of course, because in some ways, the fact that Mauritania has perhaps as many as 4% of its entire population in slavery, which makes it the most slavery-dense country in the world, is crucially important to my mind, or Haiti with 2% of its population in slavery. It's very important, but because it helps us to understand where those situations and conditions and practices exist which really sustain and maintain slavery, as opposed to a country, say, like India, which has a number of those conditions as well, but is also the country that we think has the most people, the raw number in slavery, something like 14 million out of their population of 1 billion. So in the past, the only way to get at that idea of prevalence was to dig through every possible secondary source tidbit that could be found through NGOs, government sources, police, court records, you name it, anything, newspaper reports and so forth. Sometimes capture-recapture could be used on those types of information, but capture-recapture on journalistic reports is kind of a loosey-goosey way of approaching that problem.
So that's trying to establish the degree of overlap between
yes.
different sources of information.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
But the good news with the Global Slavery Index is that after the first edition, where we did use a fair bit of secondary source analysis and a very small number of representative sample surveys, since then we've had three rounds of survey work done by the Gallup World Poll, and we've increased the number of countries each year, and we're now able to say we have representative sample data for a large number of the developing world countries. Now, it's also an interesting challenge that representative samples work in uncovering levels of enslavement in poor countries, but they won't work in rich countries. And it's because the proportion of the population is so small that's enslaved in, say, a country like Norway or even Great Britain, that you would have to have extremely large sample sizes or a very, very fine net indeed to actually find a single case of slavery. So it becomes very difficult. Now, other techniques have to be used there. But in the developing world, for the first time, we were able to unpack some of that and say, aha, you know, when we multiply these up according to the sample, we're able to say that in this particular country, India, at the moment, 14 million people out of the population of a billion seem to be enslaved. And the other part that's been very exciting for us is that there are those countries which will not allow us in. Let's take Qatar, for example, where we know that there's a large number of enslaved migrant workers working on what will be the World Cup stadium and so forth. They've never allowed anyone to come in to determine the exact extent of how many of the workers, the foreign workers in Qatar, might be enslaved. But by doing those random sample surveys in Sri Lanka, Nepal, and the Philippines, and asking households, not individuals, but households, has anything like this happened to anyone in your extended family or in your household, we've been able to point to about 22,000 individuals from those three countries who seem to be enslaved in Qatar. So we're actually getting a sort of peek around the corner mirror image of almost like a periscope into countries which would normally never allow us in to look as well.
It's like a supply side analysis, because you're actually in the countries that are supplying slaves.
That's right.
To a third country, and then you can make the inference about that third country without actually having to go to it, because you're not allowed to, or not allowed to ask those questions in that country. So it's an interesting way of triangulating the problem. You mentioned not just the prevalence, you mentioned the sort of the proportion, the total number. Do you then convert that into some sort of scale for the index, or do you leave it as proportion?
We do use a scale. We do put a scale in the index, and though we don't make a big deal out of it. I mean, in some ways, the journalists would all boycott us, I think, if we didn't give them a list which they could point to and say this country's number one or this country's number 168 and so forth. They make it very clear that, you know, we'll get a lot more coverage as long as we have that list. I've been very adamant, though, in saying from the very beginning that we can't just be about making a list of the countries with the worst, and I'm using inverted commas around that, slavery and the best on slavery and so forth, because it's unfair when you're talking about a country like Mauritania, a post-colonial country, high levels of violence, serious ethnic and religious differences and so forth, extreme levels of poverty. Of course they're going to have problems, and high levels of corruption, of course they're going to have those problems. So we've tended to use the index as a bit of a bully pulpit to not say harsh things about worst offenders, but to say harsh things about people who could do better. So certainly in the first issue of the edition of the index, it was Norway who really got it in the neck, because we said, look, you seem to have something like 400 people potentially in slavery in a country of 5 million people in Norway, where you have perfectly great law enforcement, you have good control, you have highly educated population, you have virtually no corruption. How can you even have any? Like, why aren't you slave free? And then we push, so we try to use that information to push governments and push ideas to help them to think through, well, why aren't we slave free? As opposed to people in Mauritania, some of whom are probably engaged in slavery, and so they have reasons why they want to continue it. But others in Mauritania would say, well, you know, we've always had slavery and we'd like to get rid of it, but that's a much higher hurdle to leap over than it would be for a country like Norway.
The other thing that interests me is that the basic unit of analysis in your global slavery index is the country. But is it the case that slavery is spatially concentrated? So I'm curious, you know, you don't have sort of evenly distributed slaves around a country. There are probably regions where it's more prevalent than other regions, because you talked about the north of India, for example. So do you find a kind of geographical element to the work that you're doing?
We're finding that more and more. And that's a great question, because we wouldn't have been able to even address that question until we began to have these random sample surveys with Gallup. And one of the ways that we're dealing with that at the moment is that in the edition of the Global Slavery Index, it should come out in April, we'll be using for India a brand new survey, which is not of the country of India. It's actually treating each of the 12 states or 13 states of India as if they were countries. So we're going to be able to drill down much more precisely into the incident of slavery per state. I think we're sampling over 1,000 households in each of the 13 states. So it's a very large sample of 13,000 across that entire country. And that's going to help us to answer this. But of course, you're right. I mean, there's going to be an unequal distribution geographically. But that has only been something most people could answer anecdotally until now.
So now you have a much more precise way of mapping that. And when people go onto the website for the index, they see colored maps, they can zoom in and zoom out, etc. But what's the sort of intuition behind the mapping there? Is it just to look at the kind of heat map of problem areas in the world? Is that what you're trying to achieve there?
Yes, and also to help people just understand that there's if you look here closely at that map, you'll see there are no blank spaces, that slavery exists in every country. I used to say, you know, I think slavery is in every country except Iceland. And I actually said that in a public venue, and a woman put up her hand in the audience and said, I'm an MP in Iceland, and we have it too. So I've had to start facing up to the fact that virtually every country, I think it's only some of the small island states that don't have slavery, like Vanuatu or something.
not enough people.
not enough people. And people literally know virtually everyone. But there's another thing about it, and you use the word intuition, and that has to do with the idea of if we can't do 168 random sample surveys every year, how then are we to deal with all the other countries where we don't have random sample surveys? Well, we've built behind those maps a whole series of algorithms which allow an extrapolation from known information to where we think the total should be for the countries where we're not able to do random sample surveys. So we call on a number of secondary source information points. But we've also built a series of algorithmic models which allow us to take vulnerability predictors, because on every country we're not just measuring prevalence, we're measuring up to 60 variables of all sorts that have to do with potential predictors of vulnerability to enslavement. So we use those models and also the countries around them, which often share same economic bases or cultural commonalities and so forth, to help us build predictions about where those levels of slavery should be.
So any of those estimations would come with a small margin of error.
Indeed they do.
Yeah.
Indeed they do. And I have to say, in the beginning, as we did that type of work, I was nervous. Mm-hmm. Because anytime you're extrapolating out, you have to be nervous. But I am very happy that there was a recent piece that we've published that we submitted to the Royal Statistical Society, and they kind of tore it apart and reassembled it, but then published it. And published it, in fact, in what for them is the biggest issue of the year, the World Statistics Day issue of their journal, as a good example of how extrapolative techniques can be used to show the prevalence of a serious social problem. And we'd also been able to test these extrapolation techniques against random sample surveys. So ones that had been done before we were able to sample the countries were then compared to the results of these surveys. And I was astounded that we arrived within 1% of all the extrapolations arrived within 1% of the ultimate random sample surveys, except for the case of Mauritania, which we fell within 1.5%.
But you can live with that.
I can live with that. I it's funny, but I still feel nervous.
Yeah.
And I can't quite believe we got that close.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem possible.
So in a lot of what you were saying, you mentioned quite a large number of European countries. So I'm curious about the prevalence of slavery in Europe, and you'd published a little bit about slavery in Europe, but also one of your pieces in Human Rights Quarterly actually analyzed the variation of slavery in Europe. So could you just tell us a little bit about what that article was about and what it sought to achieve?
Well, the key point of that article wasn't even as much about the prevalence of slavery in Europe, but to help people to understand the concept of the dark figure as it's applied to issues of slavery crime. And I suspect a lot of the listeners will know, but to briefly recap, within criminological statistics, every crime has what's called a dark figure. And that means the difference between the true incidence of that crime and the reported incidence of that crime.
Yeah.
So we know that there, a lot of work has gone into measuring dark figures of different types of crime. And there's a rule of dark figures, and that is that the more serious a crime, the smaller the dark figure. So murder, for example, we know probably 95% to 99.9% of all murders are reported, and they are captured in the official figures. Bicycle theft, maybe only be 20% of the people who have their bicycles stolen actually report the crime, and so forth. So there's this interesting, perfect kind of curve that shows how severity of crime reduces the dark figure, with certain crucial exceptions, because we also know that sexual assault and rape are very serious crimes which are reported for social reasons and reasons of stigma, lower than they would have been if the curve had been normal. But one of the key points of the paper was this, that all of those criminological statistics, all of those issues about the size of dark figures, is based on the idea that crimes are events. So the unit of analysis that used across all criminological statistics and national crime surveys is the idea that a crime is something that happens in a very discrete period of time, often no more than 5 minutes. Your purse is snatched, 20 minutes, your home is burgled and so forth, and then it's over, which means it can be counted. And yet, slavery is by its legal definition a crime which has an indeterminate length of time. Now, how do you then reconcile that? One of our key points was first to open up the idea, because there's been a lot of confusion about how do you estimate the dark figure of slavery crime, around the, how do we then open up that idea so that people can begin to think about prevalence versus reports if we're not able to determine if a crime event has even happened. And in some ways that calls into question even the prevalence data that we were just talking about a moment ago, because we're for the most part either hearing from people who have come out of slavery, in other words the crime has ended, or from relatives who may know that someone is in slavery, but if they don't have relatives to report, then we're missing them completely as well. We've got an estimation, it's beginning to help us to see. And for the European countries, we had built through extrapolation estimates of what the prevalence was per country. And then we were able to compare in that paper in Human Rights Quarterly those estimated prevalence numbers to the reported and known crimes, which is the standard way you would estimate a dark figure. The result, of course, is very serious, because if slavery is a very serious crime, it should have a very small dark figure. But, of course, what the paper shows is that you have extremely large dark figures, and for some Eastern European countries, it's over 90% is the suggestion, is that more than 90% of the people who are caught up as victims of slavery are never known about by the powers that be, by law enforcement or whatever. And even the countries that are much more cognizant of it as a crime and have very good law enforcement are still at the point that they may be missing 40 or 50% of the number of people who are in slavery. I think that for Great Britain, at the moment, we may be able to capture somewhere between 20 and 30%, which is actually fairly high in global terms, of the people who are caught up in slavery crime in the UK. So we're missing something like 60 to 80% of the people who are victims of that crime. That all sounds like a lot of numbers, but I just want to mention, if we were talking about murder, and we said, oh gosh, I live in a country that's doing really well, they're beginning to catch one murderer in five, or even know that one in five murdered person is dead, it'd be a national outrage. It'd be considered a catastrophe. And yet, that's just the norm at the moment for slavery crime.
So let's talk about Britain then, because you've worked on Europe, you've worked on Britain, and you had a particular approach to estimating slavery in Britain. Can you talk us through a little bit about how you did that?
Well, yes, and because as we were chatting earlier, I mentioned that it's very difficult for those random sample surveys to work well in rich countries because the number of people who are actually caught up in slavery is such a tiny, tiny fraction of the national population. We were casting around for quite some time trying to work to crack that problem. How do we measure in ways that at the moment nobody seems to know how? But I was struck by the idea of using multiple systems estimation, which, for example, the Human Rights Data Analysis Group has used so effectively to estimate civilian casualties in war, in situations of war. And in fact, those current UN figures that come out of Syria about how many people died in Syria in the last month, and currently, that's using multiple systems estimation as well. So it was about, could we transfer that technique over into slavery crime? And we made a test in the United Kingdom, working with the Home Office. I have to say, the statistical part of the work was minimal in some ways. The political part was extensive. So everyone was worried about confidentiality and looking at criminal files and how do we fit this together, and will the police departments actually want to talk to someone who's a service provider and who's in charge of this anyway, and so forth. And at one point, we even had to bring a judge into the conversation who was the leading judge in the UK on data protection, simply to say to bureaucrats and office holders, no, you won't be breaking the law by having a confidential comparison of anonymized data about reported cases. Anyway, enough of those political actions took place for the logjam to break. And it turned out a single person in a single office in Manchester could sit down with basically two filing cabinets and do the comparative work necessary to bring together six different lists of potential or probable victims of slavery crime to allow then the not desperately complicated statistical mathematical exercise, which would then say, if those are in fact the overlapping groups of people, then the size of the universe from which they are drawn is X. And in this situation, the size of the universe from which they were drawn worked out to be about 13,000. And of course, that was with a margin of error of about 2,000 in both directions.
So it could be 11 to 15, something like that.
Exactly.
I mean, to explain a little bit, the multiple systems estimation is a technique that is based on multiple sources of information about the same phenomenon you're interested in studying. And there's a probability of someone's case being reported in one, two, three, or none of those three sources, let's say, if there are three. But there's that probability of being reported is also a ratio to the total number of things you're trying to count. And that's really the intuition behind the method. So you had slave crimes being reported in one, two, three sources. That slave crime could have been the same in each of those three cases. So there's a probability that slave crime gets reported to one of the sources, two of the sources, or three of the sources, or doesn't get reported at all. So there's a total number of slave crimes that you're trying to work out, and that's your sort of 13,000 plus or minus two.
Yes.
But that technique goes right back to 19th century mathematics. It was used by the Danes to estimate fish populations. It's used by people to estimate drug users in urban centers, the feral dog populations, etc. So it's a quite tried and tested methodology. It comes with a couple of assumptions, etc. But in the British case, you were able to probe and really delve into different sources of information, collate lists, look at the overlap matching, if you will, of people and these crimes that were reported. And then from that, you were able to extrapolate this estimate around slave crime here in the UK.
That's precisely it. You explained it better than I did. Thank you. And I'm very happy to say, you know, two things that have come out of that. I mean, one was that the government responded to it very positively and immediately, even before we published the results, and said, this is in fact very useful to us. We feel much more secure in our figures now. We want to use this as a baseline upon which we can talk about funding into this area. And the second is that other governments, once it was published and accomplished by the British government, by the Home Office, have now said, we want to try this as well. Because Holland, for example, who has a special rapporteur, monitor of all human trafficking crime, as they call it in the Netherlands, has always been befuddled by the fact that they can't get a great estimate. The United States is having discussions about this as well. And interestingly, the key challenges and obstacles are the political ones about who will share information with whom and making people feel safe in terms of sharing information. It's not really about the statistical side at all. To the point that I think we may be seeing instances of this technique used at the local level. I was just a couple of weeks ago with a task force of people working on human trafficking in Orlando, Florida. And that county is a very large county. It has significant amounts. And as I talked them through the process, they said, we all do talk to each other and we all do have those lists. We just need someone to come and help us with the math. So we may actually be seeing things like localized estimations using multiple systems estimation.
It's really fantastic. And because oftentimes statistical analysis produces what I call inconvenient truths. And it's very interesting, the response of the British government here, the Home Office said, finally, we have a number we can work with. Now we can do the work that we want to do. And that sort of basic intuition is translating into other jurisdictions. So it's a fabulous example of how some of the digging that you've done and the methodological searching has led to a sort of positive outcome for a very tragic underlying problem you're trying to research.
Well, and so desperately needed. I mean, in the past, I remember being at the U.S. Congress, and, you know, talking to people about a new bill that was going to help support NGOs and service providers and increase punishments for people who had been convicted of slavery crime. And being confronted by particularly, you know, Midwestern senators who would say, but, you know, when I look at the numbers here, we only seem to have 482 people who have been arrested for this ever. Why on earth are you talking about $10 million being needed to do this kind of work? And it's a fair question. It's also one, though, that, you know, they were sort of willfully ignorant of the fact that there might be dark figures, which were, in fact, very large proportions and so forth. So if it's possible to, again, sort of almost the first sentence I said to you as we sat down to do the podcast was, if we have metrics that we can, if we have reliable yardsticks, we can begin to make progress on almost anything, whether it's epidemiological or criminological. And that's the crucial and, for me, very happy outcome of this.
Fantastic. So in the time we have left today, I have a final question, and that's about this book, Blood and Earth. Because there you're making a new argument. You're not just mapping the prevalence of slavery and looking at the sort of causal explanations or some of the demographics, but you're actually linking the prevalence of slavery to what you call ecocide. So I guess my first question would be, what is ecocide? How do you define that? And what is the relationship that you argue exists out of the work in that book?
Well, ecocide, of course, is a term that really just refers to environmental degradation. But it was Polly Higgins originated this term, to the best of my knowledge, and uses it to say we need to be thinking about ecocide in terms of the attack on the planet and the natural world, and particularly the great biome that exists in its diversity of species, which is so crucial to life. We need to be thinking about that in a totality, and the fact that it would be vulnerable to ecocide, meaning you can destroy an entire biome, and it does happen that that happens, and when you do so, it's lost forever. It not unlike the way that you think of whole peoples being victims of a genocide. It's a harsh comparison, but it's one that carries a logic to it, if you can stand back and not be human-centered, right? But the key about the book is that I have to say, around the world, I met many people in slavery. I looked at different types of situations of slavery. I tried to analyze it from business terms and human rights terms in the past. But I kept seeing situations where I would think, this place is just torn to pieces. So this place is highly polluted. This place has been destroyed. This entire forest has been removed. And I began to wonder, am I just seeing individual anecdotal instances of this, or was there a pattern? And I began to investigate this. About 8 to 10 years ago, I began to investigate, is there a pattern here, or is this just something that happens to be an occasional byproduct of slavery crime? What I discovered was that, in fact, there was a pattern. And that the pattern in particular had come about in part because of the good intentions of environmentalists and politicians who were trying to do environmentally correct things, so that a number of the treaties and particularly the set-asides of vast areas of forest in the developing world in the last 20 years have backfired in that they ended legal forms of logging and taking of timber and opened a vacuum, really, where criminals have stepped in and decided to use slavery, not to just selectively timber, but to just go into those protected national forests and take the really big, beautiful trees out first and then burn the rest. So you get this smash and grab as opposed to careful logging. What I found around the world as I looked carefully at this pattern was that it was pervasive. It was much larger than it had been in the past, in part because of these environmental regulations and treaties. And that working with the UN RED program, which is the reforestation and deforestation program, being able to estimate how much of that deforestation is occurring, and then to calculate up the carbon produced, the CO2 emissions from deforestation. Because remember, the forests represent a carbon sink. They're one of our few saving graces on our planet.
That's right.
In the sense they suck carbon out of the air.
Yeah.
But every time you cut down a forest, when a tree falls, it releases all of its carbon back into the air. And for that reason, you know, deforestation is particularly debilitating to the planet's chances against climate change, because once you've lost a tree that can take carbon out and then you release all of its carbon up, you know, you're into a bad situation. I think the factoid that it almost explains all of this is this, that when we were able to, in a very conservative way, estimate how much deforestation was being accomplished with slave labor, and again, we calculated it always taking the lower end of every estimate, using the United Nations data, linking it to the data that we have about the prevalence of slavery as well. But fundamentally, it comes to this, that if you were to think of slavery as a country, it would have the population of Canada. Or if you were to think of it as an American state, it would have the population of California.
35 million people.
Roughly 35 million
people. Okay.
If you were to look at the economic output of slavery, it would have the economic output or the GDP of a country like Angola, about $150 billion a year. Or if it were an American state, it would be Kansas, who would have thought puts out about $150 billion a year. So you would be talking about, if slavery were a country, it would be a small country in population, and it would be a small, poor country, or a low, medium-sized country and a fairly poor country, Canada, but with the GDP of Angola. But when you calculate up the CO2 emissions based primarily on slave-based deforestation, that country of slavery would be the third largest emitter of CO2 in the world after China and the United States. That's horrific on one level, but it also opens a door to a solution. Because if that's true, and I believe that it is, because the figures have been checked by a lot of other people besides myself, it means that one of the ways to dramatically reduce climate change, or at least the climbing amount of carbon in the atmosphere now, was simply to enforce laws that we already have on the books in every country on a fairly low number of people. We don't have to change the behavior of every single one of the 300 million Americans who had previously been thought of as the most carbon-hungry people in the world. We only have to change the behavior of probably 20 million people who are caught up in slavery in ways that are also environmentally destructive. It becomes almost an epidemiological question where you're able to say, these are the people who are the most serious carriers of this carbon emission problem, and we need to move our focus of intervention to those people. We wouldn't want that to happen if it only meant that everyone else would drive their gas guzzlers that little bit more out of happiness that we're reducing carbon. But it does create a situation where you could say very quickly, if the laws on the books were enforced to reduce that in a 4 or 5 years, you would actually see possibly a stabilization of the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. Still too high, still above 350 parts per million, but not continually growing as it is now.
And that connection is extraordinary, and it's a win-win situation. You both liberate people and help the planet at the same time, so it's quite a compelling argument.
It gets better, just in the sense that it turns out that, of course, if you replant the forests, if you have the people who had been forced in slavery to cut down forests, if you offer them the job and they choose to take it, replanting that forest, but you pay them well to do so, you can sell what they're doing as carbon credits on the global market, and if you actually calculate up how much carbon credit would that generate for the amount of slave-based deforestation that's already occurred, it comes to something like $55 billion, which we know would be more than enough to actually set up pretty much every freed slave on the planet into lives of good education, political participation, economic autonomy, and so forth.
And there, that closes the loop, it seems to me. So that leaves me to say thank you very much for joining me on this episode of The Rights Track. We've explored basic questions about metrics, measurement, analysis, all the way through the problems of slavery around the world, Europe, Britain, techniques for estimating that, and then solutions and really getting the ear of government through statistics, which is a really fascinating result of the work that you've done. So thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here.
This episode of The Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. The project is funded by the Nuffield Foundation, and you can find additional information and resources at www.rightstrack.com.